Welcome to The Swerve, where politics faces off with the public interest. Talk about face-offs. What a limp encounter that was on the Torrens Lake pontoon the other night with three-quarters of an audience. A full-term state election supposed to be a face-off on a grand scale, with a right to govern the state for the next 4 years at stake. But it's been pushed to one side by the debacle surrounding the Oakden report handed down last week. We've been treated to the spectacle of a Premier hanging a junior minister out to dry, giving one body up for public sacrifice, yet at the same time asserting that Commissioner Lander had no right to see relevant Cabinet documents because of the principle of Cabinet solidarity. That principle, if it can really be called a principle, is based on the possibly laudable idea that Cabinet sits, decides, and wields authority as a collegiate body. And all members are jointly responsible for decisions made, and all are committed to defending them in public, even if they happen to disagree with them at the Cabinet table. And part of that solidarity includes not letting us see Cabinet submissions, because that would reveal when a minister has taken something to Cabinet for support, but ended up being told to do something else. Don't want to air our internal disagreements, do we? This practice extends even to the Cabinet agendas, because they can reveal what went to Cabinet, when it went, and how many times it went. And to cut to the chase, it could reveal whether and when Cabinet was given information about a particular issue, with or without any decisions. For example, was Cabinet ever informed about Oakden issues in a submission? Well, even that doesn't cover every possibility, because quite a few matters can be raised without making the agenda, without a submission, and maybe even walked in to Cabinet under a ministerial arm, even where diligent public servants have the responsibility of keeping Cabinet records, things can slip through the net. There is, of course, good reason not to reveal matters which are commercially sensitive, such as significant contract negotiations while they're still in progress, or in matters of public safety and security, or where they can be unduly sensitive for individuals. There's even a good case for Cabinet discussions to be kept secret until the appropriate time for a public declaration. But politicians' judgments about what may be an appropriate time will often be different from someone else's, particularly leading up to an election, you might think. But not only then. And ministers seem to be very ready to talk about Cabinet issues when it suits their purpose, but not so much when they're in a tight spot. So under this regime, Commissioner Lander was not even able to check up what Cabinet might have known about Oakden, let alone what it might have decided to do, including do nothing. Outside of Cabinet, Mr. Lander says he was astonished at the way so many people with related responsibilities professed to be ignorant of what was happening at Oakden. There were so many people with overlapping responsibilities that one might have hoped that this would have provided technical redundancy. In that sense, the assurance that if one person missed something or didn't realise its significance, the others wouldn't miss it. But it seems we got the other version of redundancy, where none of them came into play effectively in anything like a timely manner. Now, I'm definitely not a very experienced federal court judge and have no claims to sophisticated legal understandings, but I have spent a good time of my life dealing closely with Cabinet functions and wider government management questions, and I have to admit I was, in Bruce Lander's words, astonished that it was not possible for him to make findings of maladministration about ministers in all this mess. I hasten to say that this isn't a criticism of the Commissioner's expertise or judgments, but rather an admission on my part that I had no appreciation that the term maladministration has come to be applied in legal terms so narrowly. And this, of course, has been a properly legal inquiry. It's not that it's exactly a new term. It goes back well before the Northcote-Trevelyan reforms in the UK sorted out an acceptable, more accountable relationship between ministers, their public servants, and the public interest. In its purest form, though perhaps purity isn't the best word to use here, this kept the minister's personal or political staff out of public administration and made the ministers, more usually called secretaries in those days, directly in command of and accountable for the actions of those public servants. If there was a significant stuff-up, they, the ministers, were expected to resign. They were expected to front up to the issue or the failure and accept top-level responsibility. It was called doing the honourable thing and didn't necessarily mean the end of a political career. They could plead that they hadn't personally done anything wrong, but accepted the responsibility for the performance or integrity of their administrators, before or after the fault was corrected or the mess was cleaned up. Or they could be removed by the Premier with a retirement or a reshuffle or a factional manoeuvre, which could be one interpretation of what's happened in diluted form in this series of events. Perhaps we should call them non-events. It's become the way governments handle embarrassing episodes, particularly governments which have become used to being in power. This is a prime example of what we call the swerve, deflecting the core issue with a swerve of the hips, an appearance of decisiveness, even a passing expression of regret, tiding over until the next election, perhaps, which, of course, in this case is quite soon. But how do we avoid this awful slip-sliding around responsibility, which in the case of Oakden has been accompanied by neglect, abuse and death? One pervading factor is the way what passes these days for the contest of ideas, the questioning of power, has been narrowed down in Parliament, in the media, in the social media, to the search for gotcha moments. So there's a premium in dealing with an issue on softening the attack, diverting attention to lesser issues, or showing prowess with more technical details rather than the main event. Well, particularly just now, the possibility of an ICAC inquiry can be a distinct discouragement for malpractice, but that's more at the nuclear end. Straight after an election can be a fraught time for new ministers in particular. There's plenty to do apart from thinking about an induction process. There are celebrations, choosing staff, working out a routine, finding out what's in your portfolio or portfolios. Induction arrangements tend to be bare bones, short-lived, and if you have a factional elder you can ask, they're not necessarily well-versed, even if they're confident. Good premiers will lay down some ground rules right from the start, ministerial responsibilities and the workings of cabinet. They may suggest people who can be asked for advice. That will include public servants, but particularly new governments will be wary of being captured by them on the way to do things, as well as on issues themselves. Perhaps surprisingly, some of the minister's closest and most loyal employees, their ministerial staff, can in fact get in the way more than anything at this stage. They'll be focused on getting on with a new political agenda, new policy priorities, when in the early days, keeping it simple and working out some of the fundamentals is more important. But these early days are one of the best opportunities for new ministers to really understand what they are in charge of. They need to visit the hospitals, the schools, the research units, the construction sites, to get a feel for what's not going to be in the many reports and papers they will get, for what their departments actually do or fail to do. They need to be plugged in with direct contact as well. They need to see and hear directly. And for an effective minister, those visits need to be more than royal tours, smiling and glad-handing. They're the opportunity to delve beyond the bureaucratic language of reports and recommendations to hear and see more of the practical environments their people work in. You get a much different idea of what it's like to be responsible for mental health, for example, when you've visited the ward for the criminally insane. You have to find ways of knowing what is going on, formal and informal. Of course, the same goes for senior departmental people and those with responsible jobs who work with them. You can't just wait for somebody to tell you all about it. Commissioner Lauder was astounded at the number of people with senior responsibilities, up to and including ministers, who professed ignorance of what had been happening during their watch at Oakden. I can only agree at hearing the same. But, to use the term, I'm astounded that the legal meaning of maladministration does not reach that far.